Okay. I'll tell you a little Anglican story here. You see, the Anglicans are rather obsessed with, you know, these different titles that are used and the way it works. So, you know, a normal run-of-the-mill minister is just called the Reverend. And then if you're in charge of the cathedral, if you're the dean of the cathedral, then you're called the Most Reverend. The Very Reverend. The very Reverend. And if you're a bishop, then you're the Right Reverend. And if you're the Archbishop, you're the Most Reverend. And then someone pointed out that the word awe is very close to the word revere. And so we could actually just change it and just say the awful, or the very awful, or the right awful, or the down horrible. So just call me the downright horrible. It's my great privilege and honor to be here. Thank you, Pastor Peter, for the invitation. We've got to know each other because one of the roles that I play within our parish of Wynberg is to lead our St. John's Leadership Academy. We are training pioneering mission-shaped church leaders, young emerging leaders coming up, the future leaders of the church, and not just the Anglican Church. It's wider than just our denomination. And so we have a number of, we have 18 young people in the program at the moment, and we've drawn on various people to come and be part of our wider faculty and do some teaching and input, and Pastor Peter's come and done sessions with our students, and we are just delighted to be able to partner with you and really enjoy your breadth of insight and your sound biblical basis from which you stem your ministry and found your ministry on. So it's a really honor and a privilege to be partnering with you. And thank you for the invitation to be here. I live in the area, not far away. I've run past Claremont Baptist Church many times. It's part of my running route. It's the first time I've stepped into the pulpit here, and I'm very honored to be sharing this with you. One of the things that has struck me recently is the way Jesus is rabbinic in his teaching style. Jesus was sort of recognized as a rabbi. He's addressed as a rabbi. And one of the things about a rabbinic style of teaching is that rabbis ask questions. That's how they teach. And we know that incident that happens, you know, when Jesus is a young boy taken up to the temple, and he's left behind, and his parents, Mary and Joseph, go back, and the gospel tells us that they found him amongst the elders asking questions. And if we use our little, you know, our mindset, we think, oh, well, he was like a good boy in the Sunday school. He was asking the teachers questions and they were giving him answers. No, he was teaching because rabbis ask questions. That's how they teach. And I'm sure you've heard the story about the young man who said to the rabbi, "Rabbi, why do you always answer every question that I ask with another question?" And the rabbi said, "Why not?" Or the story of the rabbi who was approached by a young man who was strong in faith, and he said, "Rabbi, I've got a question, but I'm not sure I'm allowed to ask it." And the rabbi said, "No, you can ask any question. Any question's allowed." But he said, "No, but Rabbi, this is the big question. This is really the big question. I'm not sure if it's permitted to ask this question." And the rabbi said, no, you can ask the question." So he said, "Okay, well, Rabbi, this is my question. What is the meaning of life?" And the rabbi said, "That's a brilliant question. That's a really good question. I'm glad you asked it." And he looked at the rabbi and said, Rabbi, what is the meaning of life?" And he said, "That's such a good question. Why do you want to spoil it with an answer?" Well, I want to look at a question that Jesus asks twice in the Gospels this morning? And it's a very simple question, and in fact, a very profound question. The question is, how many loaves have you got? How many loaves have you got? Now, I don't know how it is for you, but sometimes when we are confronted by a huge issue, we just don't know what to do. And let's face it, my fellow Cape Townians, my fellow residents and worshippers here in Claremont, Kenilworth, Wynberg, we have got huge problems. There are huge issues facing us. We know right now that, you know, the army are moving into Mitchell's Plain, into Mannenberg, to that area, because since the beginning of the year, there have been 900 murders. 900 people have been murdered in our city since the beginning of the year. 24 last weekend. We got big problems. From where I put my head down to sleep at night, I know that there are at least 50 people within 100 meters of where I put my head down to sleep, sleeping on the street. We've got big issues within our city, right here. How do we respond to these issues? How do we address what's going on in our country? Well, I want to take you now to the Gospel of Mark, chapter 6. I want you turn in your Bibles to that. Because we have Jesus trying to take his disciples the next level. They've been following him, but he's trying to push them to a deeper level of discipleship and of following him. And what we have is the beginning of Mark chapter 6, from about verse 7. He sends out the 12. They go out, and now they're going to start doing the things that he does, healing the sick, casting out demons, raising the dead, you know, all the basic stuff. He sends them out to go and do that. And they come back and they are really quite excited about what's happened. This is the first part of Mark chapter 6. Then there's this insertion of the beheading of John the Baptist that comes up from verse 14. And then we get to verse 30 of Mark chapter 6, where Jesus now wants to go and debrief with the disciples. He wants to take them aside, and he wants to say, okay, guys, I sent you out on the mission, you went out, you did stuff, come back, let's like debrief, let's process what happened, what didn't work, you know, how did it go? And in the midst of that, Jesus is dealing with the death of his cousin, John the Baptist, devastating for him. That's all part of the mix. This is life. This is what happens. Now, how do we be faithful followers of the Lord in these circumstances? And, you know, you showed that video earlier of what happened on Friday night, great excitement. There's all that going on. And at the same time, there's death, there's these tragedies. This is life. This is what happens. And so Jesus is pulling the disciples aside. He says, okay, guys, we need just to have some team time. But the team time gets interrupted. Verse 30, the apostles gathered around Jesus and reported to him all that they'd done and taught. And then because there were so many people were coming and going that they did not even have a chance to eat, he says to them, come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest. So they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. But many who saw them leaving recognized them and ran on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. And when Jesus landed, he saw a large crowd, and he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And so he began to teach them many things. And, you know, the best laid plans get interrupted. We, you know, fantastic to hear you're going to have this teaching session. later on, you know, for leaders here in the church. We make our plans. We're going to do some teaching. We get our slides and everything ready, and then there's an interruption. But you know, people, life happens. That's our experience of life, isn't it? You know, we make plans and then something happens. So what does Jesus do? He doesn't throw up his hands in horror and say, oh well, let's cancel it. He takes the situation that they're in and he uses it to teach them. He uses life as it is experienced to teach them. And really what I want to get across to you this morning is that we need to work out what it means to follow Jesus right here, right now, with what life has thrown at us. Not wait for something else to happen, not wait for something else to be put in place, not wait for the perfect circumstances, and then we can do it. No, we've got to do it now with what is thrown at us right now. That's what we have to do. So what does Jesus do? He calls them to be with him. They pray. Then they get this interruption. And the crowds come and they are hungry because they have come unprepared. And the disciples come to Jesus. Let's carry on reading at verse 35. By this time it was late in the day, so his disciples came to him. "This is a remote place," they said, "and it's already very late. Send the people away so that they can go to the surrounding countryside and villages to buy themselves something to eat." But he answered, "You give them something to eat." And they said to him, "That would take more than half a year's wages. Are we to go and spend that much on bread and give them something to eat?" And then we come to the question, "How many loaves do you have?" He asked, "Go and see." So what is our reaction when we are confronted with a huge problem? Something that's just sort of like overwhelming. Well, to be honest, my reaction is a bit like the disciples. Let's see how I can shift this onto someone else. I wish this problem would just go away so I can get on with what I'm meant to be doing. I'm meant to be doing this teaching session. We're meant to be having our debrief session with you, Jesus. Just like, send the people away. This is an interruption. We don't need this. How can we get rid of this problem? How can we put it into somebody else's in tray? How can these people come to us with their problem? It's their problem. Let them deal with their problem. Doesn't affect us. They've come into our space with their problem. Send them away, Jesus. And Jesus wouldn't have any of that. He says to them, verse 37, "You give them something to eat." And that's classic God, isn't it? God sort of puts these insurmountable problems in front of us. And as we read the biblical narrative, it happens time and time again, doesn't it? Daniel in the lion's den. The conquest of Jericho. I mean, how are we going to get into this fortified city? Jonah and the whale. Jonah, who was dead keen on going in the different direction. God says, "No, I'm giving you a big task." Moses, with the task of leading people, and there's a sea in front of him and an army behind him. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Ruth and Naomi, Jehoshaphat, Gideon. Gideon coming with 300 people against a Midianite army of 150,000. I mean, God seems to set us up, you know, with the odds stacked against us. And why does he do that? He does that because He wants us to rely on His unbelievable power to change things. That's why He does that. He pushes us into situations where we've got to say, I've got no other option but to turn to You, Lord. And so when we face those situations, we've got to say, okay, Lord, I'm getting the message. You're giving me something which I actually just can't do in my own strength. So what's interesting is the reaction of the disciples to this problem that's now confronted them is the typical well-managed problem-solving approach. How much money do we need to solve this problem? So what do the disciples do? They say, okay, we've got to feed these 5,000 people. Okay, what do you reckon, Peter? That sort of section over there up to the rocky outcrops, that's probably about 1,000 people there. Then there's this big section here, probably about 3 there. And then there's those people down on the side of the mountain there, probably about another 1,000 there. What do you reckon, 5,000 people? About 5,000, okay. Now, on our way up here, I saw the Capernaum Co-op. You can get a fish sandwich for 50 Rand. Maybe we can negotiate a discount, 40 Rand. 40 Rand times 5,000. That's 200,000 Rand for lunch. I mean, we could employ another youth worker for that. They resort to the approach to a problem that most times we do that. How much money do we need to fix this? What's the budget that we can use to solve this problem, to make it go away? Don't we do that? Craig Stewart, my colleague who runs the warehouse, is a very wise guy working in the whole area of social justice and that. He said, if it took money and clever people to solve poverty, we would have done it by now. Because actually, there's plenty of money around to solve poverty, and there are plenty of clever people. It's going to take more than that. So the disciples fail the test. Let me ask you this. What do you think Jesus was looking for in the disciples? What response would have given them top marks in the Galilee School of Discipleship 101 course if He had said to them, you give them something to eat? What would have been a good answer? I reckon it would have been something like, sure, Jesus, that's a big ask. But if You help us, we'll do it. I reckon that's what Jesus was looking for. Something like that. So He gives them a second chance. He gives them a sup. They can write a sup in this exam. And because He really wants them to get this, you know, this is a teaching opportunity. This is like, I didn't plan this when I was, you know, organizing, you know, to take you guys away for some debriefing and some teaching and training. But hey, it's happened. This is a teaching opportunity. How do we milk it? How do we make the most of it? And so He says, He puts this question to them, which is our big question. Verse 38. How many loaves do you have? Go and see. Now we'll come to the go and see in a moment. But this is a really profound question. Make an assessment. Don't presume. Step back. What have you got on hand? What do you actually have? You know, and very often when we are confronted by a huge issue, a big problem, we either go into let's fix it with money mode, or we go into despair mode. We've got nothing. We can't do this. I've got nothing to do. We can't even begin. And Jesus says, what have you got? And then He gives this very simple but really profound instruction. Go and see. Go and see what you've got. Go and make an assessment. And the nuance in the original language of the words that he uses, go, is retreat. Step back. Be objective. Go and actually do an audit. What have you got? Don't just presume that you know that you haven't got anything. Go and see what you have got. And the nuance behind the word see means appreciate or value or savor. So step back, withdraw, retreat, make an assessment, value, savor what you've got. Recognize, I would say, that what you have is gift. Appreciate it. And then we know what follows. Jesus is presented with 5 loaves and 2 fish. In the face of the need, just a mere trifle. And he breaks the bread, gives it to his disciples, and he does the miracle, but he involves the disciples in it. They become the channels. They become the ones that share the bread and the fish with the 5,000 and who are there also to gather up the 12 basketfuls of leftovers. So, what's the object lesson? What's the point that Jesus is trying to get across to his disciples? Well, we can sum it up in a very simple little word, gallo, G-A-L-O. Go, see what you've got. A, appreciate it, savor it, assess it. L, lay it before Jesus. O, obey, do what he tells you. That's discipleship 101 that Jesus is trying to get across to his disciples, gallo. Go, appreciate what you've got, lay it before Jesus and obey him and see what he does. Now, let me ask you this. If you and I had been there amongst that crowd and seen that miracle happen, do you think we would ever forget God's power to provide? Do you think it would change our lives forever? I see some nods and I see some people not quite so sure. Well, I know that I have seen God's provision miraculously in my life and ministry. But I want to tell you, friends, right now, I'm not in a place of great faith because we're up against it. I don't know if Claremont Baptist is swimming ahead financially. We are not. We are feeling the squeeze. Well, I want to tell you, if you think that seeing this miracle might not have changed you, you're in good company, because that's exactly what happened to the disciples. Mark continues in the gospel narrative with the storm. The disciples go out onto the lake. A storm blows up, and the boat that they're in is about to sink, and Jesus appears to them. We now at Mark chapter 6, verse 50, and he says to them, "Take courage, it's I, don't be afraid." And then verse 51, he climbed into the boat with them, and the wind died down. And bear in mind, just as a little aside, that Mark's gospel draws a lot from Peter's testimony. So this may have been the words of Peter that Mark had remembered and was recording in the gospel. Verse 51, he climbed into the boat with them, the wind died down, and they were completely amazed, for they had not understood about the loaves, because their hearts were hardened. Wow. That's an amazing bit of self-insight if it did come from Peter. They didn't understand because they had hard hearts. I think there's something deeply profound in that realization. They did not understand because they had hard hearts. I wonder if in the face of the huge issues that face us, we would be bold enough to say, our hearts are hard. We become calloused, and they don't feel. We don't feel the pain. We don't feel the distress anymore. And that makes sense if you read on, and we skip now on to chapter 8. We turn on to chapter 8, and we almost have a repeat scenario. There's another large crowd, and they've been listening to Jesus for 3 days, and they have not had anything to eat. Chapter 8, verse 1, during those days another large crowd gathered, and since they had nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to them and said, I have compassion for these people. They have already been with me for 3 days and had nothing to eat. If I send them home hungry, in brackets, that was the idea that you guys came up with last time, remember? They will collapse on the way because some of them have come a long distance. And you almost have to laugh at the response of the disciples. The disciples answered, but where in a remote place like this will we ever find enough bread to feed them? Duh! Come on, guys! Don't you get it? You know, just 1.5 chapters back, desert place, long sermon, hungry people, no food. Do you remember? 5 loaves, 2 fish, anything coming back to you? They didn't get it. They didn't get it. My observation is this. Miracles do not have sticking power. How many times have we experienced a miracle? We've experienced God coming through. and then we sort of face another situation and we're back to square one. You know, there was a while ago within I was leading Christchurch. I haven't led Christchurch, incidentally, for the last 6 years. I'm now at St. John's Weinberg. When I was leading Christchurch, we decided we weren't going to do budgeting in the normal way. We were going to work out what's the vision that God wanted for us. What was God calling us to do? And we then decided, okay, this is the vision. And then we said, this is what's going to cost. And when we presented this to the church, we didn't put the percentage increase on the previous year. We left that column out. We just said, guys, this is what we believe God wants us to do. This is what it's going to cost. And we had our gift Sunday. And the figure's not important. The size of the figure's not important. But it sticks in my memory because it was 6.71 million. That's what we needed for the year to do this. And we had our gift Sunday. And I remember the pledge secretary who confidentially took all the cards and totted them up. She phoned John by the administrator and said, John, it's 6.71. And John said, yes, I know it's 6.71. I know that's the target. He said, no, John, it's 6.71. That's what's come in. It was the exact amount. It was a miracle. The amount's not important. The important thing is it was like dead on target. That's what came in. Now, I want to tell you, today I'm quivering when I think of the responsibility of trying to raise a church budget that's going to meet the needs of the mission and the ministry. Miracles don't stick. And so I ask myself, and I ask you two questions. And you can raise a hand if you want to answer. Have you experienced a miracle of God's provision in your life? Let me ask you a second question. Do you think your quota of miracles has now run out? Well, in chapter 8, verse 5, Jesus puts the same question to the disciples again. And you know what that question is? How many loaves do you have? And we're back the same place. So don't lament what you have not got. What have you got? Count it, bring it, and it's gallo all over again. And so what happens here in chapter 8, Jesus breaks the bread, he sets it before the people, and this time seven loaves and a few small fish feed 4,000 people. Okay, now, do you reckon the disciples have now got it? You reckon they've been through this twice? Do you think they've now got the lesson? I'm sorry to tell you, no, they haven't. What happens next? The very next thing that happens is they get into the boat and they head off to Dalmanutha across the lake, where Jesus has an encounter with the Pharisees and they test him. They want a sign from heaven. And Jesus says, no, no sign. You're not getting any signs because miracles don't make any people change. You're not getting it. And then Mark tells us, chapter 8, verse 14, the disciples had forgotten to bring bread except for one loaf they had with them in the boat. And Jesus starts to speak to them about this encounter that he had with the Pharisees. And he's really saying, I don't want you guys to be like the Pharisees who are just looking for a sign. I'm trying to train you guys up as leaders of the church. You need to be operating from a different paradigm, a different way of thinking. That's what he's saying to them. So he says in verse 15, be careful, watch out for the yeast, interesting phrase he uses there, of the Pharisees and that of Herod. He's trying to get this object lesson across to them that they need to be different in their approach. And as we read the narrative, they'd zoned out. And they're not listening to Jesus, what he's trying to teach them. They are actually a bit obsessed about lunch and about the one loaf of bread that they have. And So we're in chapter 8, and Jesus says, verse 15, be careful, watch the yeast of the Pharisees and the Herods. And they discussed with one another and said, is it because we've got no bread? Jesus feeds 5,000 people with five loaves of bread. 4,000 people with seven loaves of bread. There's 13 of them in the boat and there's one loaf of bread. And they all tangled up again about provision. And so Jesus goes, ah! No, actually he doesn't. What he says is, why are you talking about having no bread? Verse 17, do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see and ears that fail to hear? And don't you remember? When I broke the five loaves of bread for the 5,000, how many basketfuls did you pick up? 12, they answered. And when I broke the seven loaves for the 4,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up? And they answered, 7. And he said to them, do you still not understand? They were stuck. They were not able to move into these deeper things of discipleship with Jesus. And the question that we need to ask ourselves is, are we stuck? He wanted their hard attitudes to break. They were going to be leaders, and they didn't need to have hard attitudes. He didn't want them to be stuck on lunch. He wanted them to be seen beyond. He wanted them to see the situation that was presented to themselves, which came, as it were, because life was happening, as an opportunity to step into the amazing things that God was doing and wanted to do among them. So what is Jesus saying to us when he asks us this question, how many loaves do you have? What are our hearts preventing us from learning? What needs to change? What needs to break? And I want to suggest that there are a number of lessons we can take out of this journey through these few chapters in Mark's Gospel. Things that need to break, like the bread that was broken in order to be distributed. And the first thing that I think that God wants to break in us is pride and self-reliance. Believing that we've got what it takes to fix the problem. That needs to be broken. Another thing that needs to be broken in us is the belief that there's a formula, that we can control the outcome. Now, I want to tell you, I did maths before I did theology, and I've plugged these figures in, and there's no formula here. Okay? 5,000. Five loaves feed 5,000 and 12 basketfuls left over. Seven feed 4,000 and seven basketfuls left over. There's no formula. There's no algorithm here. There's no control. The belief that we can manage the outcomes, that needs to be broken. The tendency to shift the problem onto someone else, that needs to be broken. The tendency to say, well, it's their problem, let them sort it out. Send them away so they can go and buy food for themselves. That needs to be broken. The desire to see a miracle for a miracle's sake, that's what the Pharisees wanted. That needs to be broken. The fear that we have used up our quota of miracles, that needs to be broken. And the lie that the problem we're facing is beyond God, that needs to be broken. And when we break something, it needs to be replaced with something else. And so when we break our pride and self-reliance, we replace that with humility and trust. Yes, Lord, I know I haven't got what's needed. I acknowledge that I do not have the resources to solve this problem. But in humility and trust, I believe you have. The desire to manage the outcome, to manage the whole process, well, we just need these loaves of bread, we bring them to Jesus, he'll bless them, and then it's all going to go okay. That needs to be broken with surrender and obedience. Lord, you said, go and see what you've got. And I've done that, and I bring it, and I lay it before you. That's what we need to do. So the desire to manage needs to be replaced by surrender and obedience. The desire to shift this into somebody else's court, being detached from the issue, having a hard heart, that needs to be broken and replaced with a heart that feels the way Jesus feels. That we weep with Jesus when he sees the brokenness that's in our city. That, I mean, friends, I live in this area. I know that we get confronted at every traffic light by someone. I know what it is to walk around the streets and see homeless people. We can get hardened to that. We can. But we've got to protect our hearts from being hardened. It's not okay. It's really not okay. And we need to say, Lord, never let my heart be calloused. Keep my heart soft and broken. Because that's how we will be in a place where God will break into our lives and we will be part of a miracle. And we need to replace that desire to see a miracle with a desire to see lives transformed. That's what we want. We don't want to just see like food expanded. We want to see people's lives changed. Keep that in our hearts, Lord. Keep that desire burning. We need to replace the fear that we have used up our quota of miracles with the trust that God is our loving Heavenly Father and He wants to continually pour good things into our lives. And then lastly, we need to replace the belief that this problem is too big for God. 5,000, 4,000, 13, we need to believe that no problem is too big for God. He can deal with it. So friends, I think God speaks to us through His Word by His Spirit. I want to lead us now in a prayerful response to what God might have been saying to you. So I just want to ask, I'm going to ask in a moment, if any of these things need to be broken in your life, if you would be willing to stand, and I'm going to pray a prayer over us all, because I know these things need to be broken in my life as well. So if there's pride and self-reliance, if there is a desire to try and control, to manage the situation, if there is a desire to want to shift this off into somebody else's inbox, to detach ourselves from the issues that are facing us, if there is a belief deep down somewhere other that miracles don't happen like that anymore, any of those things resonate with you, I'm just going to invite you just to stand and let's pray.